Iceman MVC gives you a whole bunch of different ways that you can do validation. We have a couple different built-in ways that you can do it. What I'm going to show is a new option we have with ASP.NET MVC 2 that is pretty easy to use. You'll see we're using not only in MVC, we support it in web forms. You'll see a little bit later on today, we also support it now with Silverlight. And it's using a capability that we actually first shipped in .NET 3.5 SB1 called data annotations. And so the idea behind a data annotation is, I'm just going to create a class here. And I'm going to call this product validation. The idea behind a data annotation is you can add a public property. So for example, let's add a product name. And you can basically add a declarative attribute that basically applies a annotation or input rule to it. So for example, I could add a required attribute. The annotations live in the system.componentModel.dataAnnotations namespace. And so this is going to basically say this product name property is required to make this this object valid. And in the event that it's not there, I can actually add an error message that says name is required. That should be displayed. People often ask, can you localize these messages? The answer is yes. In addition to actually specifying the string, there's also a resource type and resource name value that you can set if you want these things not to be embedded in your code, but actually pulled from a resource and localizable. I could then say, let's add here also a property called type decimal, or actually a nullable decimal called unit price. And I'm going to make this both required but I'm also going to add a range attribute and say basically I don't want this thing to be free. I want to say it has to be at least a penny in cost. It can go up to the max value of a double, and I can say error message is equal to price too cheap. Whatever I want to. And so you can basically use these attributes and apply them. There's regular expression attributes, there's string length attributes, a whole bunch of different attributes. You can also create your own attributes by deriving from our validate attribute base class and add them to yourself. So if you want to add the Stockholm specific attribute, you could do that, add it into the system. So once you do this, you basically kind of have decorated this class with input and rule validations. Anytime you use this class, you can then check to see whether it's valid. Now, right now, we're going to, I have this thing called product validation. I really want to apply this to the product class that I've generated from my link to SQL Designer. And so rather than actually embed them like here, what I really want to do is actually add them to the product class that we're using to represent our model. Now, because I'm using a T4 template to auto-generate that, I could update the T4 template to automatically add them, but since I'm running short of time, I'm not. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to hook up this validation class to the actual product class in my app and do that by saying public partial product, like this. I'm going to make this an inner class. It could also be a... there we go. It doesn't have to be an inner class. It could be a top level class as well. And then last thing I'm just going to do is to connect the two is I can add what's called a metadata type attribute, which is just going to say the metadata for this product class is actually this product validation class contained within it, and hit compile. Once I do that, one of the things you'll find is that in ASP.NET MVC, anytime we do model validation or anytime we do input, we'll now honor the data annotation rules on that class. And so, for example, if I get rid of product name and I get rid of unit price and try to do a submit, you're going to actually see on the server side when the update model method was called, it would said, hey, this model object isn't valid, and so there's a problem. And inside our admin controller here, when we try to do update model, it set all the changes and then said, is it valid? It's not valid. Because I'm using update model instead of try up model, it threw an exception. If I did try up to model, it would just return false. And then when I redisplayed the form down here, we re-rendered the view using the partially modified object. And you'll notice that I have this validate message, a validation message for each of my properties. This thing will output the error message like we saw in the UI if any of the properties was invalid. And it uses the string that we customize on the product object to do it. So that's why I now have name is required. I could change the price here to be zero and the value here to be Sweden. Notice now price too cheap is the error message we're getting. Change it to be 01. Then it submits, it's valid, and we complete successfully. So fairly easy way now with MVC2 that you can add data annotation support to your models and get it picked up automatically. What's nice is that's not the only way you can do validation. You can also roll your own validation within it. If you're using Castle Validator, you can plug that in. If you're using the Entity Library block with validation, you can plug that in. If you want to use iData or Info, that's built in. You can basically use any validation scheme you want. This one, we think, provides a really nice, clean way for the 80% scenario. Just sort of makes life really easy to do. Even better yet, we also now support both server-side and client-side validation with it. So for example, if I want to have this not only, right now this is being applied only on the server side, if I want to also get automatic client-side validation with it, I just need to do two things. Step one is I'm going to go to that JavaScripts folder, and I'm going to add a reference to these two scripts. And like so. And then I'm going to basically call one more helper method called enable client validation. Hit refresh. And now, actually I changed something, so it's invalid. Notice I change it, tab out, and I'm immediately getting client-side validation kicking in with the right error message. If I change this to be price empty, I get price required. Change this to be 0.1, disappears. Change this to be Sweden, let's save, it works. So basically just by adding those three lines of code, I now get automatic client-side validation support. If you plug in your own validation engine, you can actually tie in and still take advantage of our client validation support. So even if you use a custom validator on the server side, you can still plug in and take advantage of our client-side JavaScript support as well. And likewise, if you don't like our client-side JavaScript, you can plug in and replace it with your own. So a lot of out-of-the-box, we hope the 80-90% case gets really easy to add validation, but you can customize and extend every step along the way if you want to do something even more custom. Yeah. Got good. Good question. Yeah, so the question is when you write the error message, what does the error message look like depending on the language of the machine? And so what you can do is all the error messages that I showed here, you can use resource keys, and you can basically specify fallback rules. So you could say, here are all my error strings, and if the user has their user agent string set to Swedish, they'll come out in Swedish. If you have it in English, they'll come out in English. And you can separately control the culture for things like currency to be either auto or fixed. So sometimes we see that people want to have the currency vary based on the locale. Sometimes you want to have the currency always be in a particular currency and not have it be auto locale. So you can control those two things separately. Depends on what you set it. If you set it to be auto, then we'll actually convert the characters based on the culture. If you make it fixed and you try to use U.S. currency with a different one, then you'll get a format exception. And then you can customize what the format exception message says in whatever language you want. So it should be pretty custom customized. So anyway, any other questions on validation? Okay, question is, can I show you the underlying JavaScript? Yep. Sure. Let's do a view source. Let's See if we can blow that up a little bit. So basically, this is what the page looks like from an HTML perspective. So just standard stuff that's in my master page. There are the two JavaScript libraries I reference. Both these JavaScript libraries will also live on the ASP.NET, the Microsoft Ajax CDN, so you can pull them from the CDN if you want. Here's basically your input elements here. And so again, standard form inputs. For the extra thing we do add, if you enable client-side validation, is a hidden span that we can use to inject the error messages. This can all be customized with CSS, so you can make it look whatever you want. And then the one thing we do need to embed here is just the validation rules based on the model. And this basically just calls out to that script library that does validation and says, here's the key value pairs with the business rules or the validation rules that need to be applied. And then, so there's the end. You can also add your own client-side validation rules as well. So if you were to build the Stockholm-specific validation rule, you could build both a corresponding server and client-side behavior for it so that you could also honor it both the client-side and server. And sometimes with business rules, you can only apply them on the server. But if there is a client-side equivalent that you can do, you can also embed it that way. The last thing feature that we're adding is also for certain types of validation, like unique email address. We know you need to hit the server. And so there is an escape mechanism so that you can actually call a web service for certain validation rules to test whether something's valid and then have the client-side displayed based on that. One last question, then I'll keep going. Nope. Disappeared. Okay, cool.
The thing is, have the separator for decimals here is different from United States. So the problem is we don't get an exception if you use the wrong separator character. So we often, I've had a problem many times where you get the number times 100 instead. It doesn't parse it as a decimal character. It just strips out the illegal character.
If you can,
get it.
Yeah, if you can send me email on that, you should be able to actually configure that. What I think is happening is the default template probably has a decimal-based culture set in it. And so if you send me email, what you should be able to do is actually change the culture to be Swedish, in which point you'll actually use the standard .NET currency and date format parsers, in which case you should get the right behavior. But send me email and I can follow up on that and show you how to do it. I don't know off the top of my head how to do it. But there's somewhere, I kind of vaguely know where in the API, it's going to take me about 5 minutes to find it, that I think you can set the culture to be correct, and in which case you should get the right date-time parsing. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Unfortunately, I heard collapse in writing, and I didn't hear the middle part. Oh, make sure we get the microphone, actually. Sorry.
Could we define...
Oh, can we turn on the microphone?
What? No? Okay. Could we define the rules that in runtime that use, for example, a method of a class or retrieving from an XML file or database?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the question is, can you define rules not in terms of code on the thing, but could you actually store, for example, the validation rules in an XML file or a database and pull the rules from there? The answer is yes. The rules can actually be pulled from anywhere. And there's a good set of blog posts that I think Brad Wilson on my team did. And if you send me an email, I can put you in touch and or I can send you the URL to it. That actually shows, I think, pulling it from an XML file. But the system's totally pluggable, so you can pull the rules from anywhere. They don't require data annotations. They don't require them to be in code. And all the stuff I showed, like client-side validation, input helpers, all that stuff will just continue to work just fine. So let me keep going here, and I'll answer some more questions in a little bit. They're all good questions. A couple other features I want to talk about that are new in ASP.NET MVC 2. One is a new template helper called Editor 4, and another one called Display 4, which enables kind of much richer templating within your HTML helpers and enables a couple of cool scenarios, which I thought I'd show here. First scenario I want to show is kind of a scenario where often when you're starting out on an application, you're constantly changing your classes in terms of your data and how you map that data. And sometimes, actually, even though our scaffolding feature is great in that it auto-generates this thing for you, you end up having to regenerate it every time you make a change, which can be kind of laborious. And so one of the features we have that's new in NBC 2 is this feature we call Editor 4. And so rather than do text box 4 or checkbox 4, you can say Editor 4 and then just pass in a model object. And this can be something like model.productID, or you can actually just say pass in the entire model and auto-generate an editing form for it. And when you do this, what you're going to end up getting is, right now, this part is a bug, but basically you'll get an auto-generated form based on the using reflection based on the object that you passed into it. And so I'm just basically auto-generating a form field for each one of these. Again, this is useful when my product object is constantly changing. I can start off and just say generate the editor for the product. Once I lock it down, then I can actually go in and customize it. But this gives me a nice auto-scaffolding kind of behavior. What's also nice is that I don't have time to create the create action, but if I did, I'd end up wanting to probably use the same set of input fields in both the create and edit scenario. The only difference is probably the input form and the actual header text within the file for my views. So I couldn't use the same view, but what I want to be able to do is use the same set of input forms across both. And what you can do, which is kind of nice in ASP.NET MVC with the Editor 4, is you can customize a per-item template that you can say to the Editor 4, don't use automatic scaffolding. Instead, use a specific custom template that I want for that data type when you want to override it instead. So as an example, I could create a folder called Editor Templates. And I can put this Editor Templates folder either underneath a view-specific folder, or I could actually put it in the shared folder, in which case it will apply to all controllers within the app. And what I can then do is I can say, let's add a view, which says every time you do an editor for on a product, use this template in order to actually generate it. And I can even make it strongly typed. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to say, here is what I want the editor template to look like for a product. Save it, hit refresh. And now, anytime I use Editor 4 anywhere within the site, it'll actually take advantage and use that product template to actually render the view. And so now if I create a create view for a create scenario, I can just do Editor 4 model within that as well. And now when it's a product, it'll automatically use that product template in order to actually render it. So nice way I can get strong typing, I can get nice reuse, and I can keep my code very dry in my UI and get a nice componentization and reuse across there. Another scenario just to show off with the editor template that a lot of people often ask about is what about this category ID? It's right now it's a text box. What I really wanted to do is a drop down of valid categories. Good news is I can enable that as well. I'm going to do that in two steps. One is I'm going to go into my edit action here, and instead, in addition to getting the product, I'm also going to say, let's pass in a view data dictionary called categories, and I'm going to pass in a list of all categories. I'm then going to create another editor template that I'm going to call category list. And in this category list, I'm going to basically just create a drop-down list and basically access the categories from that view data dictionary. And then I can go into my product, and for my category, rather than say text box 4, I'm going to say editor 4. And I'm going to say, I'm going to hard code and say use the category list to render that. And now, hit refresh. Compile and hit refresh. My editor template now has a drop-down list. I can change the category, hit save. Again, it remembers it, and away I go. So I basically now create a reusable category list. And again, because it's a template, I can reuse it in any editing scenario anywhere within my site and automatically apply it. I can either, when I want to apply it, I can either explicitly list it to the editor for template, Or one of the other things I can do is I can keep editor 4 just generic like it is. And when I do that, by default, I'm going to get a text box because it's a number. Or I can actually go into my model or my view model, and I could say category ID. I could add a validation rule if I wanted to, or I can also add what's called a UI hint and say, by default, if there is a category list template for editing, use that to actually render it in an editing scenario or display scenario. So it provides a nice clean way. Again, in one place, I can say, use this template anytime you're editing this thing. I can create one template. I can compose it everywhere in the site. And now I'm using a product list edit. I'm using a category list template within a product list template, which is being used anywhere on the site in a nice, consistent way. So it's very composable, enables very clean code, very high degree of use of reuse across your code, across your site. And the same way we have editor 4 templates, we also have display templates, which are like editing, but they're about display. And so you can change and customize things there as well. Other MVC features let's talk about then are action filters. Again, going back to this concept of be able to do things one time and be able to apply it in multiple ways across the site so you keep your code, avoid any duplication within your code. Action filters basically provide a way to do this for what we call cross-cutting concerns across controllers and actions. So if you want to have some logic that always runs on a controller or all action methods on a controller, this provides a nice way to kind of encapsulate that and reuse it declaratively. So as an example, my admin controller right now lets me change product prices. I probably don't want to allow all my users visiting the site to do that, to access that functionality. And so one of the things I can do is use a built-in action filter called authorize. I can apply it either on an individual action method or just across the entire controller. And now when I do this and I try to access the edit page, if I'm not logged in, it'll automatically send me to the login form in order for me to log in. And if I go ahead and register, I can register. This is going to create the ASP.NET database if it doesn't already exist, and actually, which is what it's doing right now. And then it'll actually create the user and log me in. So now I'm logged into Scott Goo, and I have I can go back now to the edit admin page and have it work. I could also go into the authorize rule and say roles equals admin if I want to lock it down so that you must be in an admin role. Because the admin role doesn't exist right now, or Scott Goo's not in it, again, it's going to give me a access denied, or kick me to login page. I could go in to the ASP.NET admin tool either through the browser or within my web app. Go to security, enable roles. I'm going to create a new role called admin, and we'll add the Scott Goo user into it. And now when I do that and go back to the admin page, I have access. So pretty easy way that you can create that. The great thing is you can create your own action filters. We have action filters for both authorization as well as output caching and error handling all built into the box. But if you wanted to create like a custom logging filter, you could basically just derive from our base class, write 3 lines of code, and now you can declaratively set it and use it anywhere within the app. A feature that's new in ASP.NET MVC 2 is something we call areas. The idea behind areas, again going back to this encapsulation concept, is to enable you, as your app gets bigger, to kind of componentize it up and organize it in a more structured way so that instead of having a single controllers folder with hundreds of controllers or having a single views directory with hundreds of views, you can actually create areas of your app and put just the, you put the controllers and the views and the model specific to that area in one nice consistent location and have a separate area folder for different part of the app. So it just makes kind of growing your app a little bit easier. The way you add an area in ASP.NET MVC 2 is pretty easy. You right-click and you say add area. Anyone have an example area they want to create? Say forums. What was that? I didn't hear what that was. I think it was funny. But when, so if you want to create a forums area, if you wanted to create a 51. What does 51 mean? Oh, area 51. Got it. Okay. Got it. It's 4:59 a.m. my time, so I'm a little slow. I gave this talk 3 a.m. my time in Norway yesterday. I managed to misspell Oslo, which is really impressive since it's only four letters. Someone from the audience pointed out that I misspelled it, which is kind of embarrassing. But anyway, so now I have a 51 area and I have a forums area. And you can basically see there's a controllers, or maybe you can't see, there's a controllers, models, and views folder underneath each one. And there's a 51 area registration and a forums area registration class. And so basically you can even have the route specific to this area within that class, and it'll automatically be wired up. And anytime you want to create a new controller, you can do that within the area. So I could create the forum controller. And whenever you right-click and say add view, notice it'll actually create the view underneath the area section. So again, you can nicely use this to have all the controllers, models, and views specific to the forum section in one area, all the 51 files in one area, et cetera, and kind of grow out your site. Anyway, it makes it a lot easier to kind of build large apps in a scalable way. Yeah?
Refactor afterward if you decide to divide in different areas.
Yeah, good question. The question is, can you refactor at a later point? So let's say you start off like I did, where you add controllers to the main area. Can you move them into an area or vice versa? Answer is definitely yes. The only thing that's different is I think the namespace is different. And so if I wanted to move like the products controller into an area, just drag it into the area and you're pretty much done. I changed probably the namespace to map the area, but other than that, you'd be done. So yeah, it's pretty easy to refactor and move things around. You can also optionally create projects to encapsulate your area, so you can actually have a separate class library project with your area and then pull it in that way as well. And I should mention, this is something a lot of people often ask, is it required to have one giant project for everything? Like your models definitely don't have to be in your web project. You can easily have a data access layer or a model layer implemented as a separate class library project that you just reference from your web app. So that's totally supported as well. So in case that wasn't obvious. Talking about scalability, one of the other features that's new in MVC 2 for a lot of scenarios is a big difference, can make a big difference, is what we call async support. And basically what this lets you do, so async is one of these terms that it's probably one of the misunderstood, async and threads in general, kind of one of the most confusing and misunderstood concepts in computer science in general, and partly because it's overloaded in lots of different ways, and it's sometimes not always obvious the difference between threads on the client and the server, what their implication is. I always ask this interview question, you know, how are you with threading? And every time someone says, oh, I know threads great, I always give them the marker and say, okay, we're going to have fun. And usually within the hour, they're convinced they don't know threading nearly as well as they did at the beginning of the hour. At a high level, on a server, we have what's called a thread pool in ASP.NET. And so by default, we create two threads per core on your system. So if you have a 4-proc box, by default, we try to keep around 8 worker threads running on the system. And what that means is when a request comes into the system, we schedule a request on a worker thread. It goes off and does its work. And then when it's done, we basically take that thread and we use it to process another request. If you have 10 requests coming into the system at the same time, we basically have kind of an adaptive algorithm that we use to figure out, do we actually create two new worker threads so that all 10 requests execute? Or do we actually queue up two of the requests, let the first 8 execute, and then basically add more requests to the queue? And you might ask, well, why do it that way? And it turns out as you add more threads to the system, in general things slow down because you're context switching more often. And unless you're blocked on something, waiting on something, the most efficient way to actually process requests is to actually have only a single thread running on a single processor at a time. That's kind of from a server thread pool perspective. What's challenging in a web app, though, is typically you are blocking on things. You're waiting on a database. You're waiting on a web service. You're waiting on something across the internet. And so that's why our algorithm, we have to kind of adapt on the fly to try to calculate how much CPU resources are available, and basically figure out how many requests we want to execute in parallel. And we, in general, do a pretty good job at that, and that's one of the reasons why ASP.NET is so fast. Where you can help as a developer is to better tell the system when you're about to go block on something, that you're about to block on something and yield back the worker thread for us to do something with. And that way, instead of having to create new worker threads, we can reuse the threads at a more granular level. And that's where async controllers come into play. So for example, if I was going to go off and call a web service around the internet, today I could call the web service. That worker thread in ASP.NET is going to be busy until the data comes back, and then we execute. With async support, you can actually say, I'm going to go call this web service ASP.NET, and by the way, I'm going to notify you when the request comes back. And you can take this worker thread that I'm running on and use it to process another request. And that allows us to much more efficiently schedule things and avoid a thread starvation issue or creating too many threads within the system. And what's nice about the async controller support is it's now really easy. All you need to derive is the async controller base class. Within your action method, you can have both a start and a effectively when things complete method. The complete method looks just like we did before. We return views and other results. The start method allows you to call off to any number of wet network resources, tell us to notify you when the data comes back, and then we'll reuse the thread somewhere else. So it's kind of an advanced concept, but anytime you're blocking on network activity that's remote, it provides a way you can dramatically improve the scalability of your apps. And it's something that actually, to my knowledge, no other web framework actually has. We do actually support this also with WebForm pages for a while, but it can make a big difference on perf and scalability. And that's now built into ASP.NET MVC 2. So we talked a lot about features. Let's talk about testing. In general, I'd say we shouldn't wait till the end of your project to do unit testing, but I wanted to kind of walk through all the MVC features before we introduce testing so that you can kind of have a little bit of the lay of the land in terms of how MVC works. So a lot of people said they're using unit testing today. For people that aren't using unit testing or sometimes when people think of unit testing, if they haven't kind of used it before, often they think of unit testing as a way to find bugs or discover bugs in your app. You certainly can discover bugs using unit testing. The way I often think of unit testing and try to evangelize using unit testing is it's a way you can actually code with confidence and you can actually add more features and refactor your code much quicker than you can today. So it's not simply about finding bugs, it's basically giving you the confidence to add features in a much more rapid fashion. And the reason for that is if you have a bunch of unit tests for your app, anytime you make a change, you can very quickly, in a couple seconds, know whether you broke something. And so as a result, you're much more confident about making changes and adding features because you know that at the end of the day, when it's time to go home and you run your app and it doesn't work, you're not going to spend the next 2 hours trying to figure out what in the previous 8 hours actually caused you to break. What MVC does is because it has this sort of decoupled model where we piece apart the different parts of the app, it provides a lot of ways that you can actually isolate different things within the app and easily unit test them without having to run the entire app end to end. And by doing that, you can have lots of small tests within your app and very quickly run those tests and not have to make huge changes to your tests every time you actually make a change to the app. Instead, you can have very isolated changes both at the test layer and the functionality layer and quickly find any issues that you have with them. So let's go ahead and actually walk through testing something. And then we'll talk about TDD in a second. So I'm going to actually start off here by testing my controller, just in the interest of time. And so to do this, I'm going to go to my unit test project, and I'm going to say add new test. And I'm going to call this the products controller tests. And this is going to create a test class within the unit test project. This test class is a test class attribute and a test method. Basically, the way this works, this is similar to any of the XUnit-based unit testing frameworks. I simply add any number of public methods with the test method attribute, and the unit test runner will basically treat each of those methods as a separate test to run. And what I want to do is I'm going to basically, for the products controller, I want to verify that the index action renders a view. When I do this, basically I just want to make sure this thing is rendering a view. And I'm going to use a pattern called arrange act assert in order to do that. And so I'm going to arrange, basically set up the thing I'm going to test. So I'm going to say var controller is equal to new products controller. I'm going to act on it And so I'm going to say get back a result. And what's nice is I can just call the method on that controller. And I'm going to say I'm expecting a view result back. And then I can assert that some condition is true. In this case here, I'm going to say assert is not null, that the result is not null. And I'm going to say expected a view to be rendered. Like so. Again, just calling this index method. It's going to go off and do something, return back a result, and away I go. And I'm using the as view result keyword in C#. And what this does is if it's anything but a view result, it's going to assign null, which is why I can actually do the assert is not null, that it's true. Write the simple test. I could write a bunch of other simple tests to verify this functionality. To execute it, right-click, hit run test within the test runner. This is going to go ahead and try to run the test. This is going to fail. And the reason it's going to fail right now is my unit test actually requires the database in order to work. We're going to try to fix that in just a second. But the simplest way to actually work around that just for the moment is I'm just going to update my unit test project to have a reference to the database. This is generally not a best practice because it's going to slow down your unit tests, but it's going to allow us to make progress for a few minutes. And so now when I run this unit test, it's executing the controller, calling the index action, the review results coming back, and I'm testing a condition. What's nice about this is I didn't have to spin up ASP.NET. I don't need a web server, and I don't actually have to render the HTML back in order to actually unit test this. Instead, I'm able to just isolate the testing of the controller, verify that it called that view result and passed in a products model, and I can write my test. I could write another unit test if I had time that said, hey, let's make sure that not only did it render a view, but it also passed a category list to the view. And I could basically write a simple unit test also in three lines of code to make sure that the model object passed to the view was of the right type. I could go one step further and make sure that there's actually items inside that list, etc. So two or three simple conditions. And now anytime I make a change to my app, I can very quickly run those unit tests and within a second or two determine whether or not it actually succeeded or failed. And that way if I ever introduce a regression or break something, I can quickly pinpoint it and understand the problem. Now, right now, I am actually coding against the database, which is actually going to, which works, but it does mean that anytime I'm doing editing scenarios or things like that, I'm going to basically end up having to write some code to set up the database. It also is going to slow down my test because I'm having to hit the database on every time. If I want to do one extra step, I can do that, which is what's called dependency injection, so that instead of actually requiring a database, I can actually support what's called a fake database, so my test can run without a database. To do that, because of the way I've written my app, it's fairly straightforward to do. Because with Entity Framework V4, we support what's called POCO types, none of my classes, my category and product classes, actually require a database in order to work. I can simply go into my Northwind service, which is my service layer to go against the database. I'm going to extract an interface from it called iNorthwind service, which we'll use as kind of a signature contract for how my controllers interact with the database. I can then, to remove my database dependency, go into my products controller. I'm going to change this so that Northwind is instead of being a fixed type, it's actually going to be an iNorthwind service. Hit compile. Great. Everything's compiling clean. I can then change my controller to have a constructor called the products controller. That's going to take an iNorthwind service as a parameter, and I'm going to simply set Northwind equal to the service passed in. So instead of always newing up an instance, I'm instead passing in a Northwind service as an argument to this controller when it's created. And so now my controller no longer has a hard dependency on a database. Instead, when I create the controller, I can pass in either a database or anything that implements this iNorthwind service to it for it to operate against. So I basically introduce what's called dependency injection and remove the specific hard coupling with the database from my products controller. What this means is at runtime, I can actually use the real Northwind service that we've been using before to hit the database. I can also then go alternatively and create in my test project a new folder that I'm going to call fakes. And I'm going to say, let's create a new class. which is, whoops, class, where are you? There you are. Called fake Northwind service. I can implement the iNorthwind service interface. So basically, it's just going to create a stub implementation of this iNorthwind service in the interest of time. I'm just going to create one here. What this is going to do is just going to basically take a list of product objects as a in-memory objects in order to actually work against, and then I just have in-memory link queries going against the database. Going against this in-memory collection. So there's no database at all inside that fake. And then what I can do is inside my tests is I'm just going to create a helper method called create Northwind service fake. And there we go. What this thing does is basically creates a in-memory list of product objects, creates this Northwind service fake that implements the iNorthwind service. And then every time I create a Northwind or a new products controller, I can just say create Northwind service fake, compile this, and run it. And, it failed. Great. I should have tested that earlier. What I need to do is just update my Northwind service fake so that it actually returns the actual objects that it's searching for. But since Johan's giving me the list. What this basically means, if I had an extra 5 minutes I'd show you, I can actually run my unit tests now without having to require a database, without having to ever hit the database. I can very quickly, anytime I make a change, I can run my test, verify it, and I could actually create thousands of tests for this application eventually, and within 2 or 3 seconds, maybe not for thousands, but you create hundreds of tests, and in 2 or 3 seconds, quickly run all those tests and see whether or not I broke functionality every time I make a change. And so as frequently as you do Control-Shift-B in order to do a compile, you can basically run your tests and validate your functionality. Good question. So the question, let me hold that for a second. I want to show TDD first. I haven't actually got to TDD yet. Other thing I'll just mention about the unit test stuff, there's a new feature also in VS 2010 called Test Impact, which allows you to run your tests with some of our profiler API support in .NET. And what this will let you do is it'll actually analyze your tests and figure out what lines of code within the app those tests actually exercise. And so if you have lots of unit tests, anytime you make a code change in the app, you can actually just say, do test impact, and only run the tests that actually exercise the functionality that changed since the last time you ran your tests. And so that way, if you do have thousands of tests, only the subset of tests that exercise the few lines of code you changed since the last test run will actually run. So it makes it much faster in order for you to actually run and evaluate your tests. So let's talk about TDD. So I've talked about unit testing. Showed how to write a unit test, showed how you can refactor for dependency injection. What I want to do here a little bit now is talk about TDD. So everything I've shown so far helps with TDD, but is not TDD. TDD is what we call test-driven development, which is much more than just unit testing, much more than just dependency injection. TDD is about thinking about tests very early on in your process and about writing your tests, in fact, even before you actually write your implementation code. And it's something that ASP.NET MVC supports fairly well from a framework perspective. What's nice is with Visual Studio 2010, we've also had the tooling support, which makes TDD much more fluid in your overall workflow as well. So why TDD? It's hard to explain in 30 seconds, but the goal behind TDD a little bit is one of which is to think about testing very early on in your process, to design your app with testability and design principles in mind, and to make sure that you're designing it so that your app is loosely coupled and will be able to scale over time. It also helps enforce that you actually have tests in place, and it sort of, by methodology, you can't actually implement any functionality until you first have a test. And the way TDD works is, from a workflow perspective, is the idea is you first write your test even before the functionality exists. Your test won't compile. Write just enough functionality for your test to compile. Run your test. Make sure it fails. Implement enough functionality for your test to actually succeed. and then you go ahead and add a new test, and you make sure your test passes. Then you can write a new test, again, make sure it fails, and then implement enough for it to succeed and continue. So it's test first, and then implementation. So let's see how this works in VS. I'm going to get rid of this helper. In fact, let's get rid of that entire test there. And just to implement kind of how I do this, so far I've not been using a TDD workflow. What I want to do here is we're going to delete, actually, the products controller and the products controller test files entirely from our app. Even though I was using unit testing, I wasn't using test first or TDD. I was instead writing my controller first and then testing it. Let's re-implement the index or re-implement some functionality in the products controller now using a TDD workflow, where instead of starting with the products controller, I'm actually going to start with the products controller test and then implement the products controller based on it. So to start off with here, we'll recreate this thing. We'll go products controller test from scratch again. Create this class. Again, notice we don't have a products controller inside our app. We're going to say verify index action renders a view. And so I'm going to write a test name here. First step I'm going to do is I'm going to still use the arrange act assert pattern. I'm going to say products controller. Let's say products controller. Hold on a second here. Products controller. Yeah, I know. I'm trying to show off why VS isn't good at TDD today. And instead, it's cooperating with me and trying to say, no, I actually don't suck. So if I say products controller space, what you're seeing right here is what VS 2008 does today. Which is it doesn't exist, and so it's actually trying to help you by auto-suggesting the closest possible thing that does exist, because it says, hey, you can't possibly be trying to actually program against something that doesn't exist, so there's a products controller test in your project. Let's try to auto-complete based on that. And so that's what it does today. And in general, that's actually a good thing to do, except when you're trying to do TDD and when you're explicitly trying to write code against something that doesn't exist. And that kind of autocomplete functionality ends up getting in your way as opposed to helping. So what VS 2010 has is a mode called Consume First IntelliSense that you can toggle in and out of. And when you're in Consume First IntelliSense, instead of trying to aggressively autocomplete, we basically say, oh, you're probably working against something that doesn't exist yet. We won't try to autocomplete for you. And you can toggle by saying Control-Alt-Space back and forth between the different modes. And so now when I do this, I can say products controller space, and notice it didn't autocomplete. And then I can say controller. It'll still say, hey, I don't know what this type is, and give you a red squiggly, but it's not going to autocomplete. And I can then say products controller. It'll still give you some degree of IntelliSense, though, so it says, I don't know what this products controller is, but I think it's a type, and so I'm going to still give you help with it, even though I don't know where it exists. So I can still do tab and autocomplete there. I'm going to act on this type, and I'm going to say var result is equal to controller.index. Again, it's not going to get in my way because it's saying, hey, okay, you're trying to do something with something that doesn't exist yet. I get it. And I'm then going to assert. And say assert dot is not null, result expected of you to be rendered. So we wrote exactly the same test that we wrote before, but now my products controller doesn't exist. We'll do a compile. I'm going to get a compile error because products controller doesn't exist. What's also nice about VS 2010 is, in addition to the consume first IntelliSense, which enables you to write code in a little bit more fluid way without auto-completing, there's also, I can hit control dot, and there's now generate from usage support inside the IDE as well. What this means is I can actually say, let's actually have VS auto-generate a class for me based on the code that I wrote against it. So even though products controller doesn't exist, I can say generate from usage. Let's put it in the controllers folder. Let's add it to the actual app project as opposed to my test project. Hit OK. And you'll notice here that VS basically just added a products controller class into my other project and just auto-generated a class for me based on my usage within here. And now I can actually compile, and this first line of code will work. Index method still doesn't exist on this class, but I can do control dot, generate method. And now it auto-generated a stub method based on the signature inside that class. I can hit Control-Shift-B, and now I can actually successfully compile my test. I can right-click, I can hit Run Test. It's going to fail. So again, about TDD, first write the test, verify it doesn't compile, write enough code to let it compile, run the test, make sure it fails, and then now we can go into the actual implementation here, and let's derive from controller. Let's return a view's result. Let's just start off with, we'll just say return a view. Go back here, run code. Now my test passes. So I've basically started with the test, generated from usage to create enough functionality, let the test compile, ran the test, made it fail, implemented enough functionality to make the test pass, verify that it passed. And what I can then do is now write a second method, which says, you know, verify index action is passed a list of categories, run the test, verify it fails, and then basically go in, implement enough functionality to make sure I'm returning back a list of categories with a view, run the test, make sure it passes, and I'm kind of now using this TDD workflow of write test first, implement, going back and forth. And I can use that consume first model as well as the generate from usage model to get kind of a nice tooling workflow. And because MVC is kind of loosely coupled, I can structure my app and my code and get unit testing at every discrete point within the app in a pretty clean way. Good question. So the question is, so I've talked about TDD, or test-driven development. What about BDD, or behavior-driven, is it design or development? No, BDD. Basically, with behavior-driven, it's, how to describe BDD in 30 seconds? BDD is kind of another, even goes beyond TDD in terms of kind of describing specifications in terms of how you do your tests. And there's a various different approaches that you can use with BDD. There's a good unit test or a good BDD framework that Aaron, I'm blanking on his last name. Aaron, is who actually lives in the Seattle area, but I'm blanking on his name. Is working on. It's called. Is it NBehave or? Is anyone using that Aaron's BDD framework? No one here. Okay. Send me mail, and I'll send you a pointer to it. But there is a good, he actually uses a nice BDD framework that you can basically use with MVC. He actually uses it with ASP.NET MVC as well, in addition for other things. And I've never used it myself, but it looks interesting, and it gives you kind of a nice BDD-based model that you can use. And so instead of using the range-act assert pattern that I'm doing here, you could write your test using a BDD pattern, and all the consume-first IntelliSense and generate-from model should work just fine with that framework. So the question is, are we not planning to support BDD natively? We don't have any plans right now to create our own BDD framework. We won't be shipping a BDD framework with VS 2010. Instead, kind of our plan is basically to work with some of the existing frameworks out there and kind of enable good tooling support within VS 2010 and .NET 4. Similarly, a lot of people ask us about mocking frameworks as well. Instead we're pointing people to MockQ and RhinoMox and TypeMock to name a few. Generally what we're trying to do is not kind of replace good frameworks that exist, but try to work with them. Our unit test support from a test runner perspective in VS also now supports Galio based unit testing frameworks. So if you're using things like MBUnit, you can now plug in. Yeah, the same kind of right-click run tests where you get it integrated inside the IDE now works beyond just MS tests, but it'll actually work with other unit testing frameworks as well. And again, our plan is, how do we support as many as possible and plug them into our ecosystem? Yep. Ah, good question. Yeah. And of course, I deleted the test. So in the version I was doing dependency injection, I had the products controller as a constructor argument take the iNorthwind service contract as an argument. And I was using it from the test project and manually injecting it inside my unit test. ASP.NET MVC has a notion of controller factories and in general sort of factory patterns that you can implement. And so you can wire up either your own code or typically a dependency injection framework or an IOC container. Sometimes those terms are used interchangeably. And so you can use any IOC or dependency injection framework. So a lot of people use Windsor, StructureMap, Ninject. I'm sure I'm going to offend someone by forgetting where it's 5:30 in the morning my time. So there's a bunch of great dependency injection frameworks out there. And so you can wire them up. And it's about two or three lines of code that you add inside your app. And then you can use whatever dependency injection framework you want with it. Other quick questions? Any last questions on testing? Cool. And I'm getting the I'm way over time look. So that was the summary. So in terms of learning more, so hopefully you've seen kind of a quick whirlwind tour of ASP.NET MVC. In terms of it's an option. It's not something you have to use. Some people get excited about it. Some people don't. Definitely consider it as an option. Hopefully you've learned a little bit of it about in the last 2 hours to be able to tell whether you're interested or not. It does work with VS 2008 and .NET 3.5. The demos I showed today are with VS 2010. Hopefully you've seen also there's good tooling support both in VS 2008 and then with the new TDD, Consume First and Generate From support in VS 2010. There's some good testing support with that as well. To learn more, you can go to asp.net/MVC. From within that page, also quickly show, since a lot of people don't know it, there's a free book that you can download called Nerd Dinner. You can download both the PDF, and then you can also click it and read it in HTML. Basically, it walks through building kind of a simple dinner sign-up site using ASP.NET MVC. It's about 160 pages long, if you print it out. It covers everything from new projects, creating databases, models with rules, controllers, etc. For people that are interested in unit testing, there's a unit testing chapter that introduces kind of unit testing, explains range act assert, running tests, dependency injection, fakes, mocks, the whole nine yards in terms of kind of testing stuff. So all the chapters are kind of organized that fashion. I actually wrote this, don't hold that against me or hold against it. So if you're interested in learning MVC, kind of hand-holding it. Right now it's built with ASP.NET MVC 1. At some point, I'm dreading it, but I'll have to update it for MVC 2. But hopefully it provides a good way to get started with MVC as well. And you can download everything I've demoed here today yourself.